Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And this is the third in our session of sessions for carers. One of the, obviously going through fatigue in its various forms is enormously challenging. There's also a lot of challenges and difficulties being the carer of, the friend of, the family member of, the supporter of somebody that's going through that journey. And one of the things that can often happen is one's life almost ends up being put on hold, and people can end up at times almost burning out themselves by being in that role of carer. And in this series of sessions with Nick Cook, we are together kind of exploring these themes from a few different perspectives. Nick is, his wife, Lissa, has been going through her own journey with chronic fatigue. And so he's been sharing some of his experience in the previous interview. Nick shared his story and their story together. Nick has also been doing our therapeutic coaching practitioner training program. So he's also got some perspective and insight from that. I'm also at times sharing some of my experience as a practitioner. And I think I referenced in one of the other sessions that my sister-in-law suffered from Lyme disease for a number of years and actually lived with us for 2.5 years. So I got to also be in the role of carer at times and have some experience around that. So this is going to be Nick's really top five tips. And I think perhaps somewhat some of the things that he wishes he'd learned at the start of that process. But again, Nick, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me for this session.
No problem. Good to be here.
So we talked quite candidly in the previous session about your journey as being a carer. And we touched on some of these kind of ideas a little bit as part of that. And I know that one of the key themes that came out for you was, and I think it's common for a lot of people, is learning to ask for help for yourself. So yeah, let's start that, start there as kind of your first tip. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, if I was going to say one thing, it would be ask for help, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Although you're not one who's actually ill, the amount of time, energy, and sort of stress that you're going to be putting yourself under caring for somebody who is fatigued, ill, is huge. We were really lucky, reached out to my mother-in-law, and she was absolutely fantastic, actually living with us for a period of time. But also then further down the process, I asked for help, for professional help, when I was actually struggling with the sort of the later phases of Lissa's recovery and some sort of the issues of that threw up for me. Speaking to a therapist then was absolutely invaluable, and really sort of helped me. But also it was, when you sort of, you find out who your friends really are, yeah. where, particularly with an illness like particularly with fatigue, because, as we've discussed previously, people see your partner on good days when they are out and about, and, you know, so there isn't anything obviously wrong with them on those good days. So you can lose friends, and you do get missed out on that loop of being invited out and whatever, because you keep on having to say no. And by sort of, you know, taking the time to sort of sit down and talk to your friends and tell them what's going on and sort of and letting them know what's going on and just saying, you know, do keep on asking me, do keep on asking us. And, you know, do just sort of occasionally pop round and sort of have a cup of tea or pop round and say hello. You know, we might have to say, actually, it's not a good time, but don't forget us.
I think it's a really good point. And I think sometimes, well, partly the challenge can be, I think, people not really understanding what's going on. And I think perhaps the first session that we did together, where we kind of unpacked a little bit of what's often happening with fatigue, is actually a great one to send people to give them some education. But also I think there can be a certain, sometimes I think it can be pride in terms of asking for help. And I think also what can happen is people can think, well, you know, my loved one, their situation is far worse than me. They're the one that's in crisis. I need to just kind of, you know, kind of pull my socks up, as it were, and kind of get on with it. And, you know, my feelings are not important in comparison to the enormity of what they're facing. But I think that can cause a lot of problems thinking that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, so there was, I definitely had feelings of, oh, I shouldn't be asking my, you know, sort of 70 plus year old mother-in-law to sort of come and help us out in this way. But I'm so glad that I did. And if anything, one of the main thing is, it gave me sort of, you know, the opportunity to take some time out from caring without sort of that guilt of leaving Lissa on her own. And I think I allude to that later on, actually, in one of my later tips. But, yeah.
Well, I think also that help can be in different ways, right? Sometimes that help is kind of more emotional, like being able to go out for a kind of a pint with a mate and say, do you know what, it's really shit at the moment, and just to be able to kind of talk about it. Sometimes that help can be more practical, like, you know, people helping with preparing food or helping with kind of, if you need to go, which we'll come to in a bit, kind of go off and do things and have some kind of some time away. It can also be you know, some, perhaps that help can be financial help, perhaps that help can be you know, just kind of care and consideration of things that are not getting done because all the energy is going into kind of supporting that person. So there's, I think sometimes people around a family that are going through, you know, something like this often can feel quite powerless and quite frustrated. And I think people are often surprised that when you ask for help, it actually gives them something that they can do, which is often received far better than our fear that people will think that we're being demanding or being a burden or whatever else.
Yeah, and I mean, going back to my mother-in-law, her help was very, very practical. That's the sort of person she is. I think it's a Dutch thing. But she is very, very practical. But by being practical, that was also a massive emotional help as well. So it just gave me that, extra time and energy, to be able to sort of process my own emotions better. And also just as that objective sounding board, you know, there were days when Lissa was ill and she was acting out her own emotions. You know, she was angry, she was frustrated at being ill, and that would, my mother-in-law and myself would often be the recipients of that anger and frustration. And the number of times we'd just sit in the kitchen saying, gosh, she's being a nightmare today, isn't she? And just being able to have those conversations and having somebody to relate to in that way was just invaluable.
I think so. And I think not being afraid to sometimes be, you know, sometimes people are very sensitive and they can kind of see what's needed and what will be supportive. Other times just being quite prescriptive, I think, and not being afraid to actually, the thing that would be most helpful right now is that, you know, this person that I'm caring for is on this really restrictive diet and it's actually taking quite a lot of time to prepare that food. If once or twice a week you could kind of cook up a bunch of stuff following this recipe. In fact, I remember one of the kids in our eldest daughter's class had leukemia a couple of years ago, and it was obviously an enormous, you know, obviously difficult time for the family. And, you know, we're not actually that close to the family. We lived nearest in terms of location. And my wife ended up having some conversations with the mum and basically figured out the thing that they really wanted was really good, healthy food. And they were Greek by background, so kind of Greek kind of influenced food they particularly liked. And it was actually a real joy for my wife to be able to a couple of times a week turn up with like a kind of big load of food that they could freeze some, they could use some. And the fact that we were kind of given something we could do was a relief. Like it felt like we could do something actually very small in the scheme of things, support this family. And thankfully, just to end the story, the boy's doing amazingly well now, and it's a kind of amazing kind of outcome. But I think sometimes being that prescriptive, and of course the challenge was something like fatigue, particularly in the kind of severe end of the spectrum, is that it can go on for a long time. And so sometimes it requires a dialogue with people, and maybe some people are happy to do that for a month and then they've got their own life they're dealing with. So perhaps it's bringing in different people in different ways. But I think having bold, honest, transparent conversations around that isn't always easy, but I think it is important. And it's something that as a carer, it's almost like when the aeroplane's going down, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first, not because you don't care about the other people, but if you don't, you'll have passed out by the time you've helped anybody else. So it's that taking care of oneself and asking for help is really important. Let's come to your next top tip.
Next top tip is find things to do together. which it sounds really sort of simple, but if one of you is healthy and one of you is ill, it can be quite difficult. And it can lead to a real sort of separation as a couple. And that separation, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be massively physical, i.e. one of you's up in the bedroom in bed and the other one's sat downstairs watching stuff on TV. But there aren't those shared interests. There aren't those shared activities. And it took me breaking my leg whilst listening to it. To actually really come to that realization. And that's when we sort of, you know, we'd just sit together reading, or we'd binge on box sets together, or we'd, when I was able to drive again using automatic car, we were able to drive to the top of a local hill that we would have previously walked up together and just sit up there together. And so we had those, so we were able to have those shared experiences. And that was just really, really important and brought us back together again, which I think really helped.
I think that this is one that I think can be quite an adaptation for people. If they, you know, for example, I know you guys were very, very used to being active and cycling and kind of being out in the kind of hills together. And it can be an adaptation when one is used to bonding through physical exercise or through a lot of kind of, you know, social activity of, you know, if someone's younger, that's, you know, that they're kind of relationship or their friendships are going clubbing and partying, and suddenly you kind of can get out of the house. So it does take some change sometimes, and change in habits, and yet there is something that I've noticed, that people that manage to do this either in intimate relationship or with kind of close friends or with family, that is also very bonding, because actually you're spending really kind of potentially quite deep quality time together, even though it may not be through choice, and even though one party might be feeling quite unwell some of the time, there is actually an intimacy that can be built through that, which can be very precious. And I've heard people talk about how a lot of friendships have been lost, but some have been really deepened. Certain family relationships have become strained, but others have also become deepened. And I know that with my sister-in-law, we have a bond that will last a lifetime. We spent 2.5 years, barely left our house for 2.5 years. And there was, you know, endless times chatting and talking and supporting. And, you know, we'll come to this on the next one. I'm not going to deny that I was happy when she left, but there was, we, you know, a number of years later, we have a really deep connection because of that quality time that we spent together.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, another thing that obviously you can do together and you will to do together is researching and looking into the illness and recovery, etc., etc. And I think that was an important part, but I think it's important to strike a bit of a balance with that. And I think that's something that, and I was talking to Alyssa about this morning, I think that's something that we did quite well, that we didn't necessarily identify ourselves or label ourselves as somebody with fatigue and a carer. And I think that was quite important in sort of maintaining Lissa's own identity and our own identity as a couple. And that, you know, sort of this was a phase in our life. It wasn't a sticking point, that we were going to move through this and we were going to move on. And so, yeah, we did sort of, you know, sort of, you know, so I would look at the sort of the work that Lissa was doing with the clinic. I would look at the processes and sort of how I could help her with those. But we didn't become obsessed about it. That wasn't our sort of focus.
Yes. Yes. And I think if one finds themselves in a role where they end up becoming quite deeply involved in the, you know, if they're physically, you know, if someone is potentially bedbound for periods of time and one is doing a lot of things in a kind of caring role, which are, you know, can quite significantly for a time change the dynamic of a relationship. I think it's then also important that that people find ways to also connect as kind of, if it's an intimate relationship, as lovers and partners, or as kind of friends or as family. So it's trying to kind of boundary and somewhat compartmentalize, so you can still maintain the kind of the ultimate connection, even though for that period of time, some of those, there are times you have to shift elements of that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you can definitely, as a partner, and a carer facilitate recovery, but you can't fix them. And you can waste an awful lot of energy trying to do that, and sort of, you know, sort of rushing around trying to constantly do things. And I fell into those, that pattern so many times, and, you know, I probably still do. You know, there's probably still a part of me that is overly sensitive to when Lissa is tired now, normally tired rather than fatigued.
Yeah.
And that's when those sort of, oh my God, well, what can I do? Well, I'll do all the cleaning, I'll do all the cooking. And sort of it's trying to avoid going into those patterns.
I think that's right. And I think that's where building, cultivating one's own self-awareness in the process also becomes important, right? And I think that's where, if someone's, you know, working with Optimum Health Clinic, for example, you're looking at the kind of manuals, listening to the kind of recordings, the different kind of pieces that are there, and almost looking at oneself and going, you know, how's this apply to me? Because as you say, if you start trying to fix the other person, you will tend to push them away and cause more distance and more frustration. So it's how to kind of let them be the captain of the ship of their recovery, but being a really good first mate sort of thing, that you'll kind of like support them in all the best ways you can, but understanding that they already feel like they have little control in their life. The one thing they do have some control over is the choices they make on their recovery path. And it's important that you allow them to have that. Let's come on to the next one that you kind of alluded to, which I think kind of is the kind of flip side in a sense of this one.
Yeah, which is, I think it's sort of two parts. It's give yourself space, but to also, in doing so, and part of that is being kind to yourself as well, which, you know, it's easier said than done. I think with regards to giving yourself space, that has to be both physical and environmental. So I think you need to physically step away from that caring role regularly. but you need to do that in a way that doesn't create guilt within yourself. You know, you need to give yourself that time and that space. I mean, that is game, and that comes back to number one. If you need to ask for help so that you can, somebody can be there with your partner so that you can give yourself that space, then that's another reason for asking for help. Because I found, if it hadn't have been for being able to get out and ride my bike for a few hours at a time, sort of once a week or whatever, or even if it's just sort of, as you say, going down the pub with my mates, that was just a huge, huge thing.
And I think it can be easy, as we touched on a little bit earlier, to get into this mindset of, well, you know, Lissa can't go out with her mates. Lissa can't ride her bike. She's going to think that I'm being selfish, or, you know, it's not okay for me to go and do what I love to do because she can't do what she loves to do. But actually, the more that you take care of yourself, the more that you have a genuine smile on your face, not a kind of forced smile, the more that you're kind of in a good place. Often the less guilt the one that is ill feels, because it's important to remember that often when someone is chronically ill and those around them are supporting them, there can be a lot of, not necessarily they shouldn't be feeling this way, but nonetheless what can happen is people can inevitably start feeling guilty and feeling responsible for the suffering of those around them. So actually, the more you take care of yourself, actually you're alleviating that burden on the one that's suffering. But also, when they're needing a punch bag and they're needing to kind of vent how they're feeling, you can take that in a way that you're not so frustrated that you're kind of reacting and kind of flashing back at them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we also talked about that in previously as well, that part of me giving myself that space, it was also almost distancing myself when Lissa was lashing out like that, and just saying, no, that's not really her. That's the illness speaking. That's her frustration with the illness. And although she's saying, you know, some hurtful things, or yeah, that's not really her. And again, we were talking about that this morning, and she was actually saying she would tell herself after those episodes, that wasn't me really speaking. That was the illness speaking. So I think that's quite important, because they will, you know, hurtful things will be said both ways, you know, so it's a very stressful situation for a relationship, for a couple, or, you know, for a parent and a child. And you've just got to take that a little step back from it and view it objectively.
Well, one of the things that I realized in hindsight with my wife and I and my sister-in-law was that she was with us at the time that we had a newborn baby and we had a two-year-old. So we were also very much in that kind of like, don't really leave the house, taking care of kind of children kind of thing. And in hindsight, one of the things that I definitely would have done differently is made sure, you know, my wife and I did go away, you know, for the odd weekend or go on a kind of holiday. But most of the time we were kind of home, which would have meant that we were kind of in this triangulated relationship that kind of like kids would go to bed. I'd kind of, you know, finish work and it would be kind of like 8:30. And then the three of us would kind of watch TV together. And it was great in terms of kind of bonding and connecting or whatever. But it was my sister-in-law's kind of almost best time of day because she often felt the best in the day, but also it was actually the kind of contact. But what that then meant was that my wife and I were kind of in this triangulated relationship rather than just my wife and I having our time together. And if we weren't watching telly, we'd be sitting around chatting, or you know, we might have a friend over for dinner. But there, it was realizing that it would have been more skillful for my wife and I to go off and more regularly go out, the two of us, and have dinner, or to kind of just to make sure that we were taking care a bit more of us than kind of just being in this kind of situation all together. And I think we would have been a little bit more resourceful at times in terms of handling that. And I think that it's easy to see these things in hindsight. And yet at the time, you know, it's very easy to kind of get in and you're just kind of getting through each day and kind of supporting this person and wanting to kind of be there for them. But yeah, you really do have to look after yourself and take care of yourself. And I think in some ways it was easier for me than it was for my wife because I was going off to work. So I would have the kind of the day away. My wife was at home with the kids, and that, you know, that had its challenges with it, and it had its gifts in terms of the deepening and the bond of the relationship.
And you're going to make mistakes. You're going to say the wrong things. You're going to do the wrong things. And you've just got to sort of get into that mindset of, yeah, I'm not a professional. I'm not perfect. And move on.
Yeah.
You can't dwell on those sort of, you know, dwell on things. And that stems back to the whole, of not trying to fix them.
Yes.
As well. You've just got to just do the best you can.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, you will screw it up. And that's okay. In a sense that's part of being on that journey together. So let's then come to your fourth tip, which again is a kind of like feeds on from this a little bit.
Yeah, and that's changing your environment for both yourself, which is part of giving yourself some space, but also for whoever you're caring for. And I think within the course, the 90-day plan, you talk about environmental change and environmental tiredness. And that, when I was sort of reading through it, that really sort of resonated with me. When Lisa was ill, and I thought, actually, yeah, well, let's try that. And you know, you have to sort of make a bit of a judgment call, because you know they can be sort of, you know, far too tired or feeling far too ill to be able to go somewhere. But occasionally, you know, there were quite a few occasions where, with a little bit of pushing, with a little bit of sort of saying, oh, let's try this. You know, it's worked previously. It's really helped previously. Just going somewhere to get changing where we were, getting away from that bed, that bedroom, that sofa, and just, you know, sort of getting some fresh air, or just, you know, even just going for a drive, or even just going sitting out in the garden, you know, it made a massive, massive difference. It was huge.
And I think that this just to give a bit more context around this, we talk about four types of tiredness. There's a kind of mental tiredness you get when you know, one's been using their brain a lot and they become kind of tired through that. There's emotional tiredness that one gets through kind of being, giving a lot of oneself emotionally. There's the kind of physical tiredness that one gets, which is kind of in its purest form is much more like, you know, if you've been out for a kind of 2-3 hour bike ride, you might get back and it's kind of your body is physically like tired through the exertion of doing that. Then there's this environmental tiredness where you can just become drained by being in the same environment for too much time. And it's a kind of, you know, like just as a kind of simple example, it's like producing this conference. Over the last few weeks, I've probably spent about 12 hours a day sat at this desk. And so going out for a walk in the woods around the corner, or going to get some kind of fresh air, or going to kind of throw the kids around on the bed or whatever, just like something that just even as simple as that, it's amazing how it just kind of clears one's head and gives a kind of new sense of focus and clarity. And I think that the challenge for the challenge with the more severe end of the spectrum of fatigue is that one becomes quite sensitive to changes in environment. And so what happens is that people can become increasingly restricted in terms of the environment that they're in. But in a way, after a while, that can also become its own source of stress, because it's like the system just gets kind of used to being in that. And that change can be part of what will help kind of switch the system off. So even if if someone is fairly housebound, just moving rooms in the day, like moving from the bed to the sofa, back to the bed, back to the sofa, those kind of moves, even at that level, if someone's able to do that. If someone's completely bedbound, even just changing the lighting a little bit in the room, changing some of the smells, and just little subtle things in the environment will help. If someone's further down the recovery path or not as kind of severely affected, things like you were describing, you and Lisa, just getting in the car and driving to the top of a hill and just having a view and having some fresh air. But one could take the attitude of, well, I'm not doing that because I used to be able to run up that hill or cycle up that hill, and it just reminds you of what I can't do. I understand why one might think that way, but actually it's not helpful. It's much more helpful to give, well, what can I do, which is going to give that shift. And then further down the recovery path, or again, for someone that's not severely affected, it can be things like going for mini breaks, or, you know, going away for a kind of few days. And even if one is going to a hotel and doing their same routine and resting and not doing much, just that change can be invigorating.
That's quite interesting to say that, actually, because there were a couple of times fairly early on in Lissa's, when she was recovering, that we did try and go away. And we went away and it'd be fine for 24 hours, maybe 48 hours. And then she'd get a really strong, almost visceral need to be back home and back safe. And I think it was one of the real markers of her reaching a later stage in her recovery, when she wouldn't get that.
Yes.
And she would go away and she would be sort of happy with being away and being away from that safety and that routine.
And then taking this, that's interesting, and taking this back in terms of the carer, it's so important that if the person that you're caring for is restricted in their environment in those ways, that making sure that you don't then almost just by default become living on the same restrictions of getting to different places, you know, particularly if we go back to point one of asking for help, if you can get that weekend or that week or that even kind of 3 hours, whatever it may be, just to go and be at different places. And, you know, that will give one new energy, new life, new perspective, which will come back and only generally be positive in terms of supporting that person.
And I think this was very, I don't know if this was very particular to us, but I think actually one of the key moments in Lissa's recovery, one of the key decisions we made was to actually move house. Because we loved our old house and we loved the village that we lived in, and we only live about 2 miles away now, but she really came to associate that house with being ill, and needed that sort of fresh start.
Yeah, I think sometimes, I know that again with my sister-in-law, that there were times where she would go and stay with family and, you know, that would, you know, other members of the family. And then when she recovered to the point that she was able to kind of move out, that was a whole new kind of lease of kind of freshness in a sense. And she then, you know, was kind of finding where she wanted to be and then ending up kind of living out in the kind of English countryside, being another new kind of source of. And I think sometimes one does just associate so much of the kind of misery of being in a certain environment that change is like a new chapter, like a fresh start. For those that can't move house, sometimes it's just redecorating or reordering the rooms or just something just to kind of create a sense of change.
I think I just pops into my head now, actually. This weekend just gone, I was actually down in London at the OHC doing one of the practitioner training weekends. And for the first time, Lissa came down with me and actually picked me up from the centre, heading back north home. And it was the first time she'd been to the OHC since her 90-day course. And just being back in that environment, she said she found that really emotional. And I think, yeah, the impact of environment, I just don't think it can be underestimated at all.
It's funny, we've been in that same training center now for over 10 years. And it's funny, we've had people that have come as patients, then recovered, trained as practitioners, and then come to work for us and then taught 90-day programs. They've kind of gone from turning up kind of, you know, years earlier, kind of being ill, doing the program, having that experience, then coming back and being in that room as a student, and then coming back and being the one that's teaching. And just one of our newer practitioners a month or so ago was saying to me, it was their first time teaching a 90-day program. And they were like, this is really emotional for me. It's like, I remember being the one sat on the sofa the first time. So I do think environments have that, yeah, they're kind of intoxicating in a sense. And so remembering to change that and freshen that up can be surprisingly effective. This fifth one that we're going to come to, I think it's a really interesting one as well, because it's something you spoke about in the last session when you were talking about kind of your journey with this and how this has been really helpful. So yeah, it's come to this fifth one.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be formal as such, you know, so you don't need to be sort of writing sort of, you know, sort of notes the whole time or whatever, but just some keeping some form of diary on and recovery log and, well, an illness log, you know, if you want to call it. Just so, as much as anything else, you for your own sanity can see that there is progress being made, but also that you can sort of remind your partner that they are making progress, because the progress isn't going to be linear. You know, you do slip back, you know, sort of when Lissa introduces something new into her life, even if it's now, you know, if it's a new sort of, you know, whether it's, you know, starting her teacher training or whatever, that has a reaction. It makes her sort of tired. She might need to go and sleep for sort of, you know, a couple of hours when she gets home in the evening. And, you know, sort of that can make them fearful that they're slipping back into illness. And it can make you fearful. But if you can sort of look back and say, actually, well, when you did that, when you added that into your life, that caused that reaction. And then that reaction got less as you adapted to that. You have that objectivity, and you can say, actually, we've seen this pattern before. It doesn't mean you're getting ill again. It's just how this works.
I think it's really, really helpful. I remember years ago having a patient who was the FD of a FTSE 100 company. And so he had spreadsheets. And boy, did this guy have spreadsheets in terms of like tracking every kind of symptom and kind of graphs and averages. And I think he was having spreadsheet withdrawal syndrome. So he had to find a way to kind of use that part of his brain. But it was... there were times that he was kind of overly using it. It was a kind of source of its own kind of anxiety, but used in the right way and more often than not for him, it was actually really helpful to be able to go, it's incremental and I wouldn't have noticed it, but actually I am better than when I saw you last month, for example. And as you say, sometimes you've got these kind of big ups and downs, and obviously part of what we try to do is to stabilize the recovery process so it's not too much of a roller coaster. But it's really helpful to be able to go, actually, this is where I was, or this is where my kind of wife was, whoever was, compared to where I was before. And I think that's also where, you know, without wanting to become the practitioner as the carer, you can, you know, we're carefully, very carefully chosen words sometimes, you are able to just kind of remind someone, you know, I really hear that you feel terrible and it's a really, you know, you're really struggling today. And you know what? Today's bad day was considered a good day 6 months ago or 3 months ago or a year ago, whatever it may be. Because one of the things that we see on the recovery path is that over time, what we see is the highs become higher and the lows become less low. There are more highs and less lows, and the highs last longer and the lows not as long. So it's like someone will still have along the way, they'll still have those bad days for a time, but it's seeing them in context. And sometimes we might feel terrible for, someone might feel terrible for a day, whereas that would have been, as I say, a good day 6 months ago, but it would only have lasted a day as a good day, and they would have had 3 weeks of bad days. Now they're having 3 weeks of good days and just a bad day, which would have been a good day for that kind of makes sense. So it's that tracking that, and you know, be that with an Excel or a kind of Google sheet, or just even just a kind of, you know, making kind of notes of what someone can do. I think it is helpful.
And it's just, I think also there's a point, and with Lissa, she doesn't even now really remember how ill she was. And whether that's a protective thing and whether she will at some point remember that. But yeah, as you say, when she's having a bad day now, it's nothing compared to what bad days were.
Yeah.
Which for her, understandably, that's, you know, she's fearful if she's having a bad day. But being able to say, you know what, you're having to sleep for a couple of hours today, that would have been 2 weeks, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah, so you sleep for a couple of hours because you've had a really busy week.
Yeah,
training or at work, versus because you went out to the post office, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So just think, as we kind of summarize, just to kind of remind people the list. So your first one was asking for help.
Yep.
The second one was finding things you can do together. The third one was giving yourself some space. The fourth one was getting changes in environments. And this last one was keeping a diary or a recovery log. I guess a question that I also have for you is that for someone that is supporting someone on the kind of path, and they just like, this all sounds like it's that they can't change, or it's too difficult, or, you know, I am who I am. Like, what do you mean I have to kind of make these kind of changes? You know, someone's really quite resistant to the idea of changing. What was that something that you felt, or what would you say as encouragement to someone that it's possible to go on this journey?
I mean, sort of, I'd say I've changed profoundly as a person. And I think, you know, and I think Lissa did as well. And I think it's inevitable. You will adapt and you will cope. It's just making that adaptation and coping as easy as possible for yourself. I also found that part of my own change, there was a time lag with regards to Lissa's change, and that Lissa, as part of her recovery, changed and evolved hugely as a person. And then once she was better, inverted commas, I felt it was almost a sense of, wow, you've moved all this distance. What about me now?
Yeah.
And that's when I sort of, you know, started looking at doing the practitioner's course and sort of seeing how I could sort of, you know, evolve as a person and sort of, again, come together. I think you have to accept that there will be, you won't sort of necessarily grow together as a couple at the same time, but there are huge opportunities for coming back together and coming out of it the other side stronger and closer.
And I think it's hopefully helpful to say that personal growth is an inherently satisfying process. There's a pride that often comes from it. In a good way, that there's a kind of there's a sense of achievement. There's a sense of kind of becoming more of who we are in the world. And it could be quite an intimidating, scary path to start on, but it's a path that often brings a great deal of fruit and joy and kind of goodness, as it were, to one's life. And I think it takes a lot of courage to go on that path. And sometimes, you know, those that are suffering from fatigue-related conditions, they didn't choose that, and they didn't want to have to go on that path. Same is true when you're caring for someone. And yet there is opportunity in that. And yes, it's at times very, I think, appropriate to mourn the things that one's lost and to feel the frustration and the kind of grief and sadness around that. And to remember that when we grow, life also has, there are things that get better in life and things that improve. And I know that you said in the last session, we talked about your story with Lissa, that there were things about your relationship that have become significantly improved, although that you've had to grow together in that process.
Yeah, and you know, and to somebody who's, whether they're ill or whether they're caring for somebody who's ill, this might sound really sort of trite and cliched to them at the moment, and they can't possibly see how this could be true. But undoubtedly, for us as individuals and us as a couple, Lissa's illness is one of the best things that ever happened to us. And the changes, yeah, that it's brought have been incredibly positive. That's not saying that it there was, you know, it was hell. Would I go through it again? Probably not. am I glad where we are now because of it? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's because you've gone on that journey together. And, yeah, you know, that you've she's been willing to open to the journey that she's been forced into, and you've been willing to open the journey you've been forced into, and you've kind of worked together. And I think it's a testimony to both of your kind of characters and spirits as people as well. And Nick, I really appreciate you sharing so candidly. I hope this has been a really helpful session for people. And hopefully people will act upon some of what they've been hearing here. And if nothing else, at least feel that they're not alone. They're not the only one that's going through some of these struggles. So thank you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.